You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 384 is, what is there? And we read the introduction plus chapters 1, 2, and 4 of Grant Harmon's 2018 book, Object-Oriented Ontology, A New Theory of Everything. For more information about the text and the podcast, please see partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer, ontographically self-presenting in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, mediated locally in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allwun, a mid to large sized object who is not reducible to his parts or his whereabouts in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, pentamining in Madison, Wisconsin.
Pentamining? Was this a...
Wait, there's dual mining, undermining, overmining.
And pantomiming.
I said pentamining.
Oh, okay. Okay. I bullshitted mine as well. There's no ontographic chart. There's no ontographic self-presentation. That is pure nonsense. There's some interesting terminology in here. This man who went to St. John's, right?
Yeah, he's a senior when I was a freshman.
Yes, he's what we could have been doing. Did you get some kind of... when somebody, you know, that we went to grad school with or something like, yeah, I could have been in that direction. He'd been much recommended to us.
No, I'm pretty happy where I am, but I did notice reading his, I had forgot he went to St. John's, and I think I told you guys, I just saw all the typical St. John's tropes and references, and I'm like, okay, this guy goes to St. John's. And looked at his Wikipedia pages, or went to St. John's, yeah.
And we are scheduled to actually speak to him next episode about his newest book, but we wanted first to cover his more famous book, which, you know, is quite recent. It's one of the most recent books that we've done, but he's been thinking about this. I think this really goes all the way back to his first book, 2002's Tool Being, Heidegger and the Metaphysics of Objects. So that should tell a little bit about where he's coming from. But I thought, just with his presentation, at least he, given that he's going to be writing some pretty bizarre stuff, it's admirably clear. This is, you know, so this is his umpteenth presentation of this topic, and he really tries to make it accessible to new philosophy readers. And even though there's lots of sort of little secondary literature on Bruno Latour and José Ortega y Gasset and several other people, it's usually presented in a way that you don't have to know anything about them. It was only when he got to, I don't know, I dispute some of his readings, let's put it that way, when he's talking about Husserl and Heidegger. Yeah, any initial reactions, summaries?
I think he would say he's a continental philosopher, right? Or maybe he wouldn't classify himself either way.
He says as much later at the end of part of what we read.
Yeah, so at the very least, he's coming out of the continental tradition, but the way it reads, right, it doesn't have the same kinds of flourishes or maybe obscurity as some continental readings might, which I'm not, for better and for worse, right? So, but it, and likewise, so in a way it makes some grand claims. It's a theory, and it reminds me of more like the theorizing of early modern philosophy or the German idealists, and that there are some big ideas in here. But when those, you know, even the early moderns and the idealists, when they wrote, right, you sort of got a sense of the kind of grandeur of what they were doing. But here, there's a kind of plainness and modesty, even though some of the ideas are quite speculative.
I enjoyed it in part because he followed through, or is following through, facing a question or a problem that had sort of one of the reasons why I started doing, or where I was sitting doing physics and doing political philosophy back when I was an undergrad. So when I was, as an undergrad, I was, you know, reading a lot of postmodernism and Foucault and pragmatism and Nietzsche. And
I'm just imagining the paroxysms of rage some of that must have caused.
Well, so I read a lot of that. And then I was also doing a lot of physics, especially for my last 3 years. And in my fifth year, I was doing a Hegel seminar and a graduate quantum mechanics. So I had this kind of bifurcation that was going on. And what I found was that the postmodernists had something right about the fact, you know, that there's something incomplete or overstated about the claims of science. you know, even from a, you know, and then you could see this even when you were doing science that, you know, there's this kind of revisions going on and stuff like that. There's something to the notion that there is both a narrative that's involved, and even the account of how a scientist does science isn't scientific. Like the judgments that a scientist uses to decide whether or not a theory is real, is good or not, or what kinds of objects there are in the world, that's not scientific, strictly speaking. You don't have a law for what the objects are in the world. You know, you don't have a law that gets you electrons. It's a different kind of judgment involved. So there's something right about that. On the other hand, they just completely didn't engage with taking seriously both the claims and the practical success about accounting for reality in some way. So you have these like extraordinary flourishes. This would get to what Wes is saying about what might, you know, make me really irritated, is that postmodernists would say something like, well, it's all just a text. It's a Derrida thing. And I met Rorty, who was in this weird position of being a pragmatist and a postmodernist, but not exactly. And he would say things like that. And I asked him personally, do you really think that all of science is just more literature? And he just said, yes. It didn't engage the question with me at all. And so I found myself in this position where there's something to the notion of recognition of metaphor and aesthetics and the fungibility of ideas in science. But there's also this in philosophy, especially in the postmodernist stuff that I was reading, just frankly didn't even engage seriously with the notion that you have a world in front of you that you actually interact with in ways that are much more palpable and quantitative and real than they were engaging in. And I felt like in reading this that like that's right where he is. He's right in the middle of that question.
I mean, Rorty's an interesting comparison just because he was familiar with the Continentals, but he still writes in a clear, nice way. In some way, I was comparing this to the John Searle book that we read as sort of a counter to that. So John Searle, when we spoke to him, was saying that, you know, all of so-called modern philosophy and thinking, all we have in contact with is our own ideas, representations of things, and we never actually come in contact with the things. That's all just ridiculous. I want to be more commonsensical than that. And this is also an attempt to be more commonsensical in a certain way, more true to like, of course there are objective objects in the world that have nothing, that are mind independent, that would be there whether any humans were living on Earth or not. Of course. But denying that central Searlean claim that we have actual contact with them. So he wants to actually bite the bullet and take a Kantian position explicitly that what we experience are a world of phenomena, sensory objects, he calls them, but when we're actually talking about, I guess this is a point of ambiguity, we're getting into it. When we're talking about a physical object in the world, right? This is something that's going to be in his ontology. So he's arguing in favor of common sense against somebody that says, well, no, they're really only molecules or atoms, and the macro objects are just can be reduced
strings,
to
Mark, strings.
Yes, they can be reduced to strings, or oh, you know, that table is just a social construct. We should just treat it as a functional object. We should only think of something as the sum of its relations to everything else in the universe. He's going to say both those things are crazy. I just want to actually talk about objects, but that introduces, as with Kant, a skepticism that objects are objectively there in the world. Well, what is it? You know, we have illusions. We only perceive sides of objects. We only perceive parts of objects. And so he wants to create this slice that a lot of continental philosophers, every single one after Kant, starting with Hegel, he's reading Heidegger as a return to Kant on this. They really wanted to get rid of this idea that we have no contact with the actual world that we talk about. When I'm talking about the table, I'm talking about the real physical object that would be there, whether any humans, well, obviously we built the table, but so a rock, whatever, you know, that it's entirely independent of people.
So I agree somewhat with a little bit of whatever everything's been said. There's a kind of audacity to the approach and the claim. There's a clarity to the way it's written. There's an openness to referencing all different sorts of figures, but there's also a little bit of, it feels a little dilettantish at times, kind of bouncing around from thing to thing. So, you know, it started off And when you hear object-oriented ontology, at least I have a particular thing that is brought to mind. I think of Whitehead. I think of the idea of somebody trying to provide an alternative to, you know, traditional Aristotelian substances and the idea of, you know, trying to solve or address the concerns about the thing in itself, you know, something like that. And it's a very compelling opening where, you know, he draws the analogy between the theory of everything, a theory of everything that is apparently being searched for in physics, and then, you know, a theory of everything philosophically, like so something that would explain materialist and non-materialist things and not simply either dismiss the one or declare that they're two completely opposed and, you know, never to be conjoined things. So I appreciated that and was, you know, excited, of course, by the references to the phenomenologists, and also excited when he sort of in chapter two brought up this notion of aesthetics and the idea that there's alternative approaches, conceptual approaches to the world that will. So somehow, at least in what we've read so far, it hasn't quite come together for me yet. So I kind of like it, but I also feel like I'm sort of wandering around. It's like, okay, now let's talk about Mino for 5 pages.
Yeah, it is. It's a presentation for lay people, right? So for people who are not professional philosophers. And so there's a lot of gaps. And I don't know, you know, if you look at professional articles, if some of those are filled in. So for instance, on the idea of the aesthetic as giving us some access to, or indirect access to reality, or that we can't get descriptively. Well, that's a very old idea that also comes out of Kant and comes out of Kant's third critique and is elaborated by the Romantics and even makes its way into German idealism a bit. So there's no discussion of that. And there's also no discussion in his discussion of metaphor on like the vast philosophical literature on metaphor and how that might line up with what he wants to say about metaphor. He's not going to defend the idea that we don't have access to things in themselves. And as Mark mentioned, you know, immediately after Kant, I don't know if Reinhold was the first person, letters on the Kantian philosophy, but immediately people were objecting to the idea of the thing in itself. So, and Hegel, right? You know, that's one of the big attempts to solve that problem. So there's not going to be any discussion of that or any sorts of justifications, or any delving into academic literature. There's just a very straightforward presentation that's largely devoid of getting into the academic weeds. And, you know, at certain points he wants to delve into Plato's Meno a bit, which does seem a little bit forced maybe for the work it's supposed to do with justified true belief and the concept of knowledge. So I get what you're saying about all that, Seth. Yeah, I had the same sort of impression.
I mean, the juxtapositions are kind of surprising sometimes and in a way that was fun. Like it wasn't till, so just to give us the structure, this book has 7 chapters, the last of which is just a summary that Wes read and said we didn't have to read because it would just really didn't add anything. And so the chapter one introduces it, and I could just call it Against Scientism. It's called A New Theory of Everything, but it's really, you know, why his idea of an ontology as opposed to a reductionist ontology of some sort. So it's a very promiscuous ontology that what we're going to count as real objects in the world could be just momentary confluences of things. And Seth, you mentioned Whitehead, right? I thought that object-oriented ontology was supposed to be opposed to a process ontology. But he explicitly says, like, no, I consider events to be objects. So I have such a wide ontology that just about anything fits into it. Then chapter two was this thing on aesthetics. So we can talk about that. And then chapter three was on society and politics, which I did end up skimming. You read it, Wes, right? Mm-hmm. Which I thought was pretty skippable. But then chapter four was the real meat. And it kind of enraged me. And I kind of want to talk because that's where he gets into Husserl and Heidegger and Kant on the thing in itself. And just this epistemic idea. I want to hold off my rage about that to actually present it in something like the order that he presents it. So we can talk about overmining and undermining and duo mining and stuff in chapter one first.
Yeah. We could try and get through chapter one at a pretty brisk pace if you want. And then maybe do chapter four before chapter two.
Yeah.
Since that's what you, yeah.
I would do that.
Right. Just as you referred to, Wes, it's chapter two. Chapter four is there are things in themselves, all the objects we talk about, in fact, tables and chairs. It's not just like whatever it is, an unknown X that lurks behind what we call tables and chairs. No, there's an actual real table, real chairs that are in the world that we will never have direct access to and so can actually have no knowledge of. So he has to tell us in chapter four, well, what is knowledge then if it's not that? Chapter two is though, we can, as you referred to, Wes, have some sort of indirect access to the objects, the things in themselves through art, through metaphor. And we've talked about, you know, Schopenhauer and other folks that thought things like that, but it is a little bit of a tangent.
The reason that he has the aesthetics chapter in two there is to prepare you for what he means by indirect access. So he wants to lean on metaphor and aesthetics as the mode of indirect access that gives us knowledge. So he wants to give you enough of that in order to have some kind of clarity about what he's going to mean in the end when he talks about indirect access in chapter four.
Yeah, and I forgot to mention, you know, besides the German romantics, there's Schopenhauer, I guess, overlaps a bit with that. So, right, Schopenhauer's conception of the thing in itself is as will. And so we do have access to things in themselves, says Schopenhauer, because we are willing creatures. And we, in a way, we can grasp the thing in its selfiness of everything out there in terms of its manifestation of will, which turns out they're barnacles on the great big God will in the same way, right, that Spinozan individuals are barnacles on God, properties of God, but with this added dimension of will. So it sounds very similar in some ways, this idea that we put ourselves in, as it'll turn out, and we'll explain this more later, but put ourselves in the place of the object that is being elaborated using a metaphor, but to which we gain access only in a sense by putting ourselves in its place. And yet he doesn't really mention Schopenhauer. And I don't know if that's just for simplicity of presentation and that it comes up in other of his writings, but it's just the sort of thing that anyone who's read a bunch of philosophy is likely to take note of. But yeah, but Dylan, yeah, you know, that's the point, is to talk about how we might get indirect access or some sort of access to things in themselves. There's an old tradition, you know, there's a long tradition of people making these similar sorts of claims.
In this way, you know, the audacity is he's trying to solve a very old problem about how do we know things in the world, and, you know, the variety of solutions that you have to solving that problem, and the way in which our access to the world is mediated by our minds and our senses, but it also has this part of it that is sort of manifestly there, just all the problems that you have with just the way in which we interact with the world and the world interacts with us. And he comes down that of being, on the one hand, Kantian in some important ways, you know, but he wants to wrest back realism from it, from Kant. That's one way I think I would put it. And he glancingly, you know, points to the aesthetic work that Kant did and talks about his ethics a bit as part of framing it. And one way I might have put it is he is applying Kant's ethics and just going further than that to an ontology about the world that's based upon aesthetic judgments. In the end, he has this whole section where he's explicitly trying to also not rely on a third step, basically the God step, whatever version of God it is. He wants to make it all effectively secular. It's us in some kind of contact, but not direct contact with the world. So the world is real. We have contact with it, but not direct contact with it. And that account is formulated in object-oriented ontology is an attempt to account for all of our interactions with things.
But we as things in themselves, as we are also things in themselves, and we are ourselves, right? So we have a special kind of access there. But we stand in a sense.
Yep.
We substitute ourselves in for the object out there to which we can't have direct access. So that, you know, it does sound a little bit like Right. So we do that instead of making this appeal to God, we make the appeal to the self, right? But that's just one of the metaphysical objects. You know, you're just shifting the burden from one metaphysical object to another. And so I'm not sure it's all that different than God, right? And God and the consciousness come together in the German idealists. So I think Mark is worried that we're getting a little bit too fuzzy and vague here.
I mean, this is really mysterious when he brings it up in chapter one and says, look, I'll explain in chapter four. So we're just following him in throwing these things more or less out there, right? We had this idea that we discussed in our Malebranche episode. And then actually you could see like, okay, maybe this is even a Descartes of occasionalism. So that's what Dylan was referring to, is that you would think that if you want to really have an objective account of the world, you know, you're a Randian objectivist, then you don't say causality is in our head. You say causality is really in the world. Just like objects are really in the world, you know, a part of what anybody might think of them, they have causal relations. But that's not, just as there's this rift between us and the objects in the world, well, of course, that's basically a causal relation, right? The object in the world is supposed to cause something in our senses, which gives us some kind of idea. So if he's going to say causality doesn't make any sense between us and the world, he's actually going to say exactly the same thing happens between, you know, billiard ball one that is going to hit billiard ball two. Those are both things in themselves, and they cannot come in contact. So there is no causality.
Yeah. So when we get into four, I have a whole bunch of questions about what he means by direct contact and not having direct contact and stuff like that. We'll have to get into that.
So let's rewind it just a little bit back here to one and try to use some of the language that he's using so that we can at least set the stage. Because he's tackling the big stuff. There's nothing small about this enterprise, right? So part of what he's talking about is that we figured out over the last 400 years or so that our epistemological relationship to the world is one of knowledge. And that knowledge is of qualities or attributes we experience, and we come to get knowledge of objects in the world through their attributes or qualities, right? And he says, this presents us with the problem that we can't seem to access the quote-unquote objects which actually possess these qualities. There's a gap, and this causes consternation. And there have been a bunch of different ways that philosophers have tried to resolve this dilemma. And he says, I'm going to take on that same problem. I'm just going to come up with a different approach, which isn't idealism. In other words, it doesn't appeal to something above and outside that overdetermines the object and guarantees our epistemological place in the world. And I'm not going to appeal to materialism, which appeals to something that's underdetermines or undermines. I don't remember the language exactly, but, you know, and he says, oh, well, it's all just atoms. And that explains it, right? That's the real thing, is the atoms, or the real thing is the form or the idea, right? Or God's secure attachment to it, or whatever it happens to be. And he says, I'm going to give you an account that explains how we know attributes. We have regular old knowledge like we know, but I'm also going to give you an account that explains how we have access. You know, he doesn't want to use the term knowledge, but access to those things that we think are somehow behind those attributes. So he introduces this nomenclature of real and sensible. So there's a real object and a sensory object. And then there's, we'll leave this on the table for now, real qualities, but there's also sensible qualities. And then he starts speaking in that language about how traditional knowledge works and perception and so forth versus what he's trying to get at. So I just want to introduce that because I think we should start using that language as we kind of get into his argument.
Let's pause for a word from our sponsors for this episode, starting with Shopify. Channel the fresh start energy of the new year and finally launch your business with Shopify. 2026 is the year to rewrite your story, own your future, and make your entrepreneurial dreams come true. Start your business with Shopify in 2026 and become who you're meant to be. New year is the best time to finally start that business you've been thinking about. We all have great ideas and skills, but it's taking the first step and finally taking action that turns your dream into your new future. Keep the fresh start urgency. January is short. The most powerful move to make it all happen in 2026 is to start your business with Shopify. Shopify gives you everything you need to sell online and in person. Millions of entrepreneurs have already made this leap, from household names to first-time business owners just getting started. Shopify gives you all the tools to easily build your dream store, choose from hundreds of beautiful templates that you can customize to match your brand. Setup is fast with Shopify's built-in AI tools that write product descriptions and headlines and help you edit product photos. Marketing is built in too. Create email and social campaigns that reach customers wherever they scroll. As you grow, Shopify grows with you. Handle more orders, expand to new markets, and do it all from the same dashboard. In 2026, stop waiting and start selling with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/PEL. Go to shopify.com/PEL. That's shopify.com/PEL. Hear your first this new year with Shopify by your side.
You know what nobody tells you about weeknight dinner? It's the thing that never goes away. It's there every day, after work, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. There it is again. HelloFresh doesn't make you a better cook. It just gives you your nights back. Weeknight dinner isn't about being good at cooking. It's about the mental load of figuring it out every single night when you're already exhausted. You go and you show up at the end of the day, you've just finished work, and you want to make dinner, but you don't know what you're going to make. HelloFresh removes that completely. With pre-proportioned ingredients, step-by-step cards, all done in 30 minutes. They have over 100 recipes every week. You pick what sounds good, not what you can figure out how to make. And bigger portions mean nobody's still hungry after. For me, I just recently made a salmon dish with some sour cream and nice sauce on it and some panko breadcrumbs and some roasted beans on the side. It was really nutritious. It tasted delicious. And all I did was follow the instructions. For me, it just has the satisfaction of putting it together without a lot of thought, and it tastes delicious. HelloFresh brings you sustainably sourced seafood, antibiotic-free chicken, and seasonal produce that actually tastes like something. They have over 35 high-protein recipes weekly, plus Mediterranean and GLP-1 friendly options. Weeknights are not just about dinner. It's time and energy and the ability to actually sit down instead of standing at the counter stress eating while you cook. When dinner tastes as good as it does with HelloFresh and takes this little effort, you finally get your nights back. I use HelloFresh and you should too. Go to HelloFresh.com/PEL10FM to get 10 free meals and a free Zwilling knife, a $144.99 value on your third box. Offer valid while supplies last. Free meals applied as discount on first box. New subscriber only. Varies by plan.
Do you want to start with chapter one and give why science can't provide a theory of everything and his arguments against the four assumptions there? Physicalism, smallism, anti-fictionalism, and literalism.
Yes.
So he begins by reminding us of string theory as an attempt to give a theory of everything. And a kind of theory that will unite, I guess, different trends in physics. And apparently physics can ultimately explain everything because everything is ultimately made of matter. And then he's going to move on to objections to the idea that science can explain everyone. And the first objection, he's going to say there are four false assumptions. And the first one is physicalism, which is the idea that everything is reducible to physical material components. And his primary example there is the Dutch East India Company, which he's going to say is real, but not material. And we're all very familiar with that kind of move in philosophy, right? We can't say exactly where it is. It was, you know, spread out over various locations. It lasted for 200 years. All of its material elements changed. The people involved changed. The boats and various other things. So it was a form, really, and with shifting material components. So the Dutch East India Company is not reducible to its material components. It's an example of an object, what he would call an object, that is not material.
And it has a history. So it's not even like the ship of Theseus that he brings up. Well, that's a form. It's the same ship. If you were on the ship once and then you went later, you might have a new paint job, but it would look, the structure is the same. The bow is in the same place. Whereas the East India Trading Company, like, well, it got bigger, it got smaller, it got, you know, it can go through lots of important changes, but still remain the same thing.
This would be true for any association or group like we've been talking about for the last few weeks.
Yeah, he could have picked a country, he could have picked a city, he could have picked a family, he could have picked all kinds of things that are combinations of physical objects. He could have picked the weather.
Pretty much anything you can name.
Yeah, but it's a good example in that we would very naturally call it a thing. In fact, we treat something like the East India Company as an entity in a very natural way.
Ultimately, we do need criteria for entities, and he doesn't say a lot about this, but he gestures at that, right? He says his ontology is flat to begin with, so we're kind of promiscuous and inclusive. And maybe even in the beginning, we do the thing that Aristotle's unwilling to do, which is to say it's not just Socrates who's a substance, an entity, a unity, right? All those things go together. But Socrates on the chair, we might want to call an object too. We might want to take an odd hack combination like that and call it an object. Now, I think ultimately, probably for him, that would fall out. As we got into our ontology, we would end up agreeing that Socrates on the chair is not. It might be a certain kind of object for certain kind of purposes. But would it be a thing in itself? Would it be a unity in itself? I think we would ultimately have to reject that, but it's a bit unclear.
It's similar to the question, well, a difference between a thing and a heap. So a heap as an entity.
But this is really going to get into our Ellis episode came to mind, where he was not promiscuous about what counts as a real entity, as in something that actually has an essence, right? That he was working on this Aristotelian picture, that there's a definable essence. This is what science is trying to get at. You know, Harman says, you know, a lot of his reasons for insisting that things themselves are, you know, that is, which is what science wants. Well, sorry, I'm already getting ahead of myself. Yeah, just go on.
Yeah, I think Wes is right. I think maybe it'll be interesting to ask him this, whether Socrates on a chair is a thing or not. My guess is that it is. I don't see why it's completely depends on the context in which you were considering it.
Yeah, it's a bit unclear to me because he does say that we would, it's hard to tell what's ad hoc in our, you know, what's a heap and what's a unity. And so we're somewhat agnostic about that in the beginning. But let's, I don't think there's a lot of clarity on that in this text. But
yeah, importantly, he doesn't show any concern about essences.
Well, eventually.
He does talk about essences in chapter 4, but.
This is what stopped me in my going through this is because I thought maybe for something to be a real entity, it has to have an inner nature that could be explored or you could ask questions about. And he does say, you know, that one of the ways that he is, you know, he points a lot to Latour and how Latour allowed for lots of more kinds of entities, including hybrid entities, so that you wouldn't think, so maybe Socrates on a chair, Socrates using the technology, maybe that ends up being a hybrid
entity. Smoking a cigarette on the corner.
Yes, yeah. Something like that. but thinks that actually Latour was not promiscuous enough, that he should have allowed these momentary, really, events. So Socrates... Yes. In the act of right now sitting on the chair, maybe that is actually something that we could analyze that. We could make a metaphor about it. We could talk about. And importantly, like the collision, like he actually uses this example, the collision between two airplanes in the air. So, you know, the collision between Socrates' butt and the chair that could create a temporary entity, right? The collision, which then goes away, right? That entity only lasts for a second, but it then, you know, has grave effects on the component parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty grave if you're in the planes. Less grave for Socrates' ass in the chair, but...
This is one of the questions I think we're going to end up gnawing on a lot is he clearly wants events to be objects. And it feels like there's a distinction that I would want to make between objects and events. And it might be just that I don't have a promiscuous enough idea about what objects are. I think that's part of his answer. But I guess I want to understand better what problem he's solving by insisting that that's the case.
Yeah. See, I'm not ultimately very happy with this use of the word object. I don't know what it adds to promiscuously use the word object in this way. You can see him, I think the best case for it is in a way made in chapter 2, where he gives an analysis of the... Civil War.
Chapter 3.
Yeah. And there seems to be a certain methodology that comes out of this that might have application to the social sciences. Now, I don't really think you need object-oriented ontology to do history, for instance, but yeah, he gives a nice cogent analysis of the Civil War and applies object-oriented ontology's methodology. So I think readers could look at that and think, okay, is this, if they want to know whether it's useful, that's a really good case example.
Yeah. To me, he's trying to get rid of the problem between being and becoming by having events be things. So it allows for, you know, the full dynamicness. And so Aristotle had it in a different way, right? He has things have their own nature, and part of their nature is becoming the thing that they are.
Yeah, there is no entity without dynamism for Aristotle.
That's right.
What we see is static, and what seems to be at rest, the substance, the entity, is driven by some underlying dynamic thing. It's driven by circular motion, essentially, because just as an atom, right? The thing that keeps the atom being the atom is, even though it's all motion, is that there's a circle in a sense. It may not really look like a solar system, but, you know, something like that.
Yeah. So that's what I was constantly reminded of Aristotle when I was reading what he's doing for this reason.
Yeah. Well, so this is why I thought of Whitehead, right? So if you're saying, how do we explain the eternal, persistent, unchanging object, or how do we explain change in that eternal, persisting, you can say, oh, well, there aren't things, there are only events. Everything is becoming. That's one way to do it. There's nothing eternal.
Yep.
And the other way is to say, oh, well, you know, becoming is part of the thing. It's not, you know, our conception of the thing. So you can change how you think about objects, or you can say, well, we don't have objects. We only have something else, like, you know, what we call events. But I remember about 20 minutes ago when we kicked off on this, somebody said we should talk about those four things that he says he's...
So we have the second one now.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, with this remaining 20 minutes, there's a possibility we'll get to these three other things, and then we could explain overmining and undermining. And I think that would be the essence, if there are essences, of the
the essence of the chapter.
So smallism, right, is this prejudice that everything that exists must be basic and simple, and that you kind of drill down to get that, right? You decompose things, you do mereology and decompose things into their parts, and ultimately you may get atoms or strings or whatever. But all the idea is that all the properties of mid and large sized objects, you know, that the macro level that we experience in our daily life, are reducible to this other realm of tiny, simpler things. And he's going to want to make the claim, again, you know, something we've seen many times on this show, that actually these emergent properties that appear when smaller objects are joined together, it's perhaps the case that you could predict them from the, you know, what's going on at the micro level, but they have unique properties of their own, and that, in other words, the whole is more than the sum of the parts.
Exactly.
And an interesting point, I'm trying to find exactly where it is, that he adds to this is, it doesn't even matter, like people often make the point about emergence is, could you predict what the whole is going to do based on the parts?
It's on page 31.
Yes. Okay. And he says, even if you could predict what this, you know, oh, if we get these four people together in a group, and with these technologies and these structure, then this is what it's going to come out. Even if we could do that exactly, he says, yes, predictability is not even the point. Since even if we could predict the features of all larger entities from their ultimate physical constituents, the ability to predict would not change the fact that the larger entity actually possesses emergent qualities not found in its components. So there you go.
Right. So we can do this with carbon and organic compounds, right? We can often predict macro properties from features of carbon and the way it's combined with other elements, although I do have a quibble with them on that, but I'm not going to go there. But it doesn't change the fact that, right, whether or not we can predict doesn't change the fact that there are such emergent properties. And it's, right, emergence, the joint, the kind of properties of that occur of the compound are not themselves found in the components. So each layer, right, there's a sense in which it's not entirely reducible to the other layer. So if we want to talk about biology and evolution, for instance, we couldn't just translate that and all into talk about atoms. There's something that would be lost if we just did that translation, if we tried to translate everything into atom talk or string talk.
And even you've given the example before from Lucretius, atoms aren't colored, right? Color is an emergent property. When you get a bunch of atoms together, now, I'm bringing an observer there, right? So this raises an issue of, is there any sort of primary, secondary quality distinction, right? Primary qualities, space, are supposed to be more central ontologically than secondary qualities. It seems like he has to say that green is a real, it's still a property, but it is a real thing. It is an entity because, you know, the same green, if I have a green bag, you might see it differently in different lighting conditions. You know, if you squint your eye, if you have are colorblind, whatever. So there actually is a real color that this thing has. He's not going to be able to rule that out just based on, well, you don't have colors till you have, you know, light plus an observer plus, like, it's still, it's okay. It can be a hybrid like that.
Yeah, the distinction here is between epistemological and ontological emergence, which he doesn't bring up, right? Ontological emergence would be, oh, there are colors that are emergent upon the properties of light and things like that. And it's not just a matter of our eyes, the way things affect our eyes. And then epistemological emergence is primary secondary quality theory. And in Lucretius, it's probably ontological emergence, but it's a little bit unclear in Lucretius. But it, yeah, it seems here that Harman is probably leaning on ontological emergence, but it's a bit of a problem, right? Because Kant is all about epistemological emergence. There's unknowable things in themselves, and then everything that we think is a property of something is just a result of the interactions of our minds and their categories and spatiotemporal tendencies to construct everything, you know, what we're interacting with in a certain way. But again, not something that's here in detail. Do we want to do the third one, anti-fictionalism?
I mean, we can mention it, right? Sherlock Holmes, that is a character that we talk about. The possible worlds guy. There's one we had, one of the analytic guys.
Davidson or yeah. not David. Was it Davidson?
I don't know. We talked about Sherlock Holmes in particular quite a bit on one of these
we did.
Things. Maybe this was on the possible worlds guy, David Lewis. I think that might
Lewis,
have been
yes.
Right.
That's what it was. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So you want to allow fictional entities to be objects in your ontology. What did you guys think about that?
Well, yeah, the way he says it is everything that exists must be real. That's a false assumption. So Sherlock Holmes is a thing and it exists, but it's not real.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes isn't made of strings. He's made of fictional strings. No, he's not even made of fictional strings.
He's not real.
Fictional characters, but
yeah,
he's...
This to me is fine. It just raises the question about... Now you have to make the distinction between real things and not real things.
Yeah. So he brings up these literary characters as a way of saying what I think we saw in Quine. He doesn't mention Quine, but I remember Quine specifically saying macro physical objects are theoretical constructs, right? We have all these different views of different sides of it and they stick together. And so we just call it this table. Whereas, you know, I think he compared it to like the Olympians or something like that. And so Harman says on page 34, any real orange or lemon, as I perceive it, is a vast oversimplification of the real citrus objects in the world that are submitted to rough translation by the human senses and human brain. The real orange or lemon is no more accessible to my human perception than it is to a mosquito or dog whose organs translate the fruits differently into their own types of experience. In this respect, all the objects we experience are merely fictions, simplified models of the far more complex objects that continue to exist when I turn my head away from them.
Okay, so this part annoys me a lot. This is where, to me, he's doing something that's very common in postmodernism, is all the objects we experience are merely fictions. In this respect, they're all merely fictions. When you say it that way, to me, it means that they have no bearing on reality. And I don't think that's what he means. I think he's trying, or maybe it does, is what he means, but what the hell does something like that mean?
Well,
all these objects are merely fictions. What it reads is it's just, if when someone says that, it just means it's just horseshit. That's what that means.
No, I think so. In the Kantian interpretation, which I'm sympathetic to as a possibility, although I happen to like Aristotle and Hegel as well. I don't know how to decide. There's just so many choices. But the Kantian possibility that I am sympathetic to is that it's all just secondary qualities that we have access to, right? And so we may be in the matrix, and at bottom, the lemons might just be code. Let's just say that. And okay, that's fine. That's fine. Maybe everything that we have access to, the color of the lemon and the taste and all that, is just that's mind object interaction. And those properties don't belong to lemons in themselves. And neither they do spatial properties, what the early moderns thought of as what the in itself for the early moderns is everything that's spatiotemporal. That's their scientific view of the world. And Kant says, no, that's all secondary qualities as well. All right. That is fine. I think that's a sustainable point of view, but that doesn't change the fact that if the cat is on the mat, the cat is on the mat. If the cat is code and the mat is code, at bottom, okay, fine. But contingent truth, which, by the way, Kant does a very bad job. Kant doesn't really address this problem of contingent truths, like the cat is on the mat. As we go forward in this book, we do know that that's true. That's not inaccessible to us. Like, if the cat is on the mat, the cat really is on the mat. If John is in the living room near me and I'm not deceived about that, then John really is in the living room. Now, John may look like something else in himself. And so might the living room, but it doesn't change those contingent truths. So I think, I don't know if I'm getting at your intuition here, Dylan, about what's so objectionable about this, but that's what I would say about it.
So I don't know if his use of the term fictions is an unfortunate choice or if it's deliberately provocative, but I don't think it's doing what you guys think it's doing. You know, what he's trying to say is you have a bias that tells you that your ability to perceive something in the immediate present that's right in front of you is giving you some kind of privileged access to that thing, and that you have some kind of experience or knowledge of it that is several degrees removed from something like a fictional character, or if that's too objectionable, how about a real character that lived in the past, like Abraham Lincoln, right, or Alexander the Great, that's existed and was real and is no longer real, right? Maybe that makes it more complicated. But what he's just trying to say is whatever that representation you have of that thing is just a representation. I think that's all he's saying. He's not saying that it's fictional.
That's the Kantian position. All we have are the appearances. All we have are secondary qualities. He's telling us over and over again, he's a Kantian, and fiction is his way of saying appearance.
Well, sorry, then Dylan is concerned with something else.
Here's my objection. It's in the second part of his sentence. All the objects we experience are merely fictions, colon, simplified objects of a far more complex objects that continue to exist when I turn my head away from them. Simplified models are not fictions. They might be partial information, but they're not fictions in that if I am making a model that is not a fiction, I am describing something, maybe partially, but that about which I can make decisions about the world, about things that will actually affect me. I might have a simplified model about how gravity works, but I'm going to use that to keep me from jumping out a fucking window.
That's a dramatic version of my cat is on the mat example.
Well, and he ends up agreeing, right? He says this very provocative thing at the very beginning, page 6, no one is actually in possession of knowledge or truth. And so strictly speaking, that's going to be the case, but we have a lot to go on. We have expert, we have contact, yes, with reality is what he's going to say. So we've opened the Pandora's box. Let's start our part 2, engaging directly what he has to say about these things in themselves, which is what we've just opened with this last quote. But I think we should shut down and give ourselves a few minutes to recover.
We don't want to do literalism before we get off here.
Just do the fourth assumption really quick, 5 minutes.
And then I think we will have to start part 2 with that. I don't think much is going to make sense if we don't do undermining and overmining first, but anyway, literalism, right? He wants to object to the idea, to the assumption that everything that exists must be able to be stated in literal propositional language. So the thing that he brings up is Dennett's form of literalism, where there is no qualia. So wine, right? The taste of wine can be adequately expressed by a chemical assay. Like our subjective sense of what the wine tastes like doesn't actually add anything. That's some kind of delusion or illusion. And he wants to say that even the chemical assay doesn't do justice to the chemical physical structure of wine. There's something in reality is always withdrawn or veiled rather than directly accessible. So any attempt to grasp that reality by direct and literal language will inevitably fail. And this, I think, again, is just, it just kind of builds on the Kantianism. And we can say, in the case of science, right, a scientist might provisionally say the same thing. What we're saying about water at, yes, the macro level fails to capture what's going on with the H2O molecule, the deeper reality. But Kantianism just kind of expands on that sort of idea and radicalizes it.
Yeah. You stopped your quote right at the end on page 38 of that section, where he summarizes, as in a sense, this point by Heidegger, which he was referring to about things not being directly accessible, merely developed Aristotle's ancient claim in his metaphysics that individual things cannot be defined, since things are always concrete while definitions are made of universals. That, I think, is a really great point, right? That, you know, an account in science, for instance, it's intrinsically expected to be universal, right? And so in this way, the world, you know, the things are concrete, and the world is always bigger than the account that you're going to make of it, of the definition you're going to make of it. And that's something that he's going to hold precious. The world is basically bigger and more interesting and more voluptuous than any of our accounts of it are.
All right. So we'll see how that very reasonable statement matches up with the claim that there must be Kantian things in themselves and stuff in part two. Come back next week or become a Partial Examined Life supporter through our website or Patreon. Learn about those options. PartiallyExaminedLife.com/support. Thanks.
Thank you.